Good evening, you. That's you. Right, you are you. Listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung hey. Radio. And we know this because you can't close your ears. So if this is on in the room, you are hearing it.
Well, we can say that you're hearing The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio.
That's
we
true.
Can't really say if you're listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Nicholas.
Yeah, it's hitting your eardrums. At whatever volume
do your
eardrums
work?
Yeah,
maybe they don't.
That's true.
You know, but you're definitely the vibrating air. Should you be tuned in, the vibrating air is moving and it's hitting your body in some form.
Right.
Do you detect that?
Maybe you hear differently. Yeah. Maybe you detect.
Maybe you're some sort of moth-like person who feels it more as a ripple within your antenna.
Yeah. Or an abdominal listener.
Maybe this is being played through a sort of hydrophone and you are in a swimming pool or you are a cetacean or a whale or something like that.
Which we will finally admit after all these years is our preferred way of intaking the show if you have the means to listen or hear it in a hydrophonic environment.
If you are a whale, I salute you. Happy breeding season. Fun in Mexico.
Yeah. But either way, I'm still Nicholas Miller, and this right here is still Steve Cato.
Wonderful to be here.
Great to be here. So nice. So how are you doing, Steve?
I feel like ambiently stressed out by work, even though there's really not that much to do, and it's not that different than normal.
Yeah, sometimes just the hurdle of getting into it at all is stressful.
That's weird. And like stuff like, you know, Adobe Illustrator fans out there will know that like making a gradient is very simple. And selecting a color for a gradient is very simple. And somehow, you know, today I was like, this is hard. and that's just not true. It's not hard. What's my problem? That's maybe the theme for today for me is what's your problem? Anyway, that's me. How am I? I'm like that. I'm sorry.
Yikes.
there is a bar in Toronto that's technically the lobby of a boutique hotel that, and it's a boutique hotel that, like, doesn't seem particularly great. And it's not a fantastic bar. The ambiance is much more like being at, like, a more upscale airport waiting room. And they had a cocktail called I'm Sorry Your Face.
Oh, jeez.
And I feel like that's kind of like, that's like what Adobe products are saying to me today. They're saying, like, I'm sorry, your face.
Is it supposed to play out in like a funny way with the bartender? I guess not really. You say like, hey, I'm sorry, your face. That doesn't work.
No, I mean, like I've never ordered it. Yeah. It sounded gross, but I was also just sort of like, wow. Well, like it was so impenetrable because like they've made a uniquely unpleasant bar and then you'd think that like that would be a joke that you could make. Yeah, right. Like there's like you say, I'm sorry, your face, and it's like a punchline to something. Or
yeah,
like the
inverse of Cafe Gratitude. You're like, I'd like to have I really
Cafe
hate
Attitude?
You. Cafe Attitude. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you think it would work in some sort of similar way, and it's just impenetrable. You just cannot interpret what that even means. And I think about it often, you know, cause it's like, language is such a trip, you know, you can get anything.
Yeah.
You can say anything. You can say the name of this drink is I'm sorry, your face.
Right. You can organize a vast group of people, and train them to kill people in distant lands and assign them titles, that make pretty much no sense.
Yeah, you can call the larger number of people the infantry. You can call them babies.
Yeah.
And you can call lieutenants placeholders.
Steve just told me before the show that the etymology of lieutenant is placeholder.
Yes, in French, lieutenant.
Oh, so the French, it's clear sense to them.
Yeah, and in French, it's very straightforward. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, placeholder.
Right.
Place tenant, you know? And I'm like, well, that's weird. It's funny how many words like that exist that are, like, literally compound words, even in the sort of language you speak, and you never take them apart.
It's true. I'm trying to think of an English example, but I can't off the top of my head.
No, me neither. I said that, and I should have just had that lined up, but...
Like breakfast.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's
breaking your fast after you've gone to sleep.
But you just say breakfast, like it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, no, it doesn't have any connection to shattering.
When I went to a Jewish breakfast, I was like, wait. I thought it'd be eggs and sausage and stuff. Not sausage, of course, but, you know.
Veal. Right? You know, precisely. It's this kind of thing where you're like, wow, that is so weird. The things you just take for granted when you learn the language a different way. Lieutenant. And then that led to looking up the etymology of infantry, which is babies.
I mean, infant being the first chunk of that word makes sense, that it would be babies.
But then you're sort of like, what a messed up approach. Because most of the organizations I've ever been in, all the babies are at the top of the organization.
How so?
Think about it, man. Like, the people in charge, total babies.
Oh, okay.
Can't do anything for themselves, just, like, waving their arms around. fix it, fix it, fix it. I need this now, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, total baby behavior, you know? Like, adults, don't do that. You know, you do stuff.
You wipe your own butt.
Shut up. You wipe your own butt. Yeah, precisely. Babies, come wipe my butt. And... with an actual baby, I'm fine with that. I accept that you're learning to use your body, and you need the help of older people to get around and stuff. That's fine. When you are signing everyone's checks at the end of the day, it's sort of like, well, it's embarrassing, you know? Like, wipe your own butt. Anyway, it's funny. So it's funny that clearly these titles are produced from the people on top, and they're like, "Well, I'm not the baby.
I'm the general. I'm more general than the baby.
I'm not even remotely specific. I'm, you know.
Well, if you have to look up, if you're taking requests, Steve, I'm going to put in a request for Colonel. I wonder what that means.
Oh yeah. It means that you make popcorn.
I bet it means crown.
Oh, yeah, coronel or something. Corona, kind of like that kind of... you're thinking that's where the etymology is tending.
That's my guess. Feel a strong pull towards crown.
Is a colonel more important? What's the... generals are number one?
Yep.
And then what?
Well, there's the compound ones I can never remember, like Lieutenant Sergeant or Sergeant Lieutenant or something.
But Lieutenant General.
Yeah. Right. I think compound always is like an interstitial step.
A placeholder, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know so well. I should. My dad was in the military, and he sometimes, after some beverages, will brag about having achieved, you know, placeholder status or whatever he got to. But I can never remember. I want to say he was a lieutenant. Lieutenant Miller.
I'm placeholder baby at your service.
Yeah. Yeah, you're too old to still be a baby, but we don't know what to do with you yet, so we will make you placeholder.
Jeez Louise. All right. Now that we're doing speculative etymology, what do you think a sergeant is?
Oh, geez. I think sergeant has to do with the verbs, certain verbs that one would use in battle, like they come from this side or something like that.
Sarge.
Yeah, like they were the group that they would sarge from the int or something.
Uh-huh.
That's my guess. How about you?
Like je sarge, tu sarges with an S, il sarge with a T.
Yeah.
Nous sergeons, vous sargez. Il sergent with an ENT at the end.
Uh-huh.
Like that's what you think?
Yep.
Wow. Well, I wonder if you're right.
it sounds good, right?
Yeah. My move was speculative. I was doing the same thing as lieutenant, and I was taking the word apart in the middle. So it was like tsar and giant.
Oh.
So you're like, you're involved in like, this is, it's like one of the older
words
in warfare. Yeah. Or like you're in like the older part of one of the older ranks in military history where you were in charge of like doing something with the giants. You would wrangle someone's going to wrangle the giants. Someone's got to make sure that the Ents, you know, the sentient trees are all on, you know, it's like these kind of jobs that people would have in older forms of military conquest. You know, I'm thinking like in around the historical era of like Middle Earth or something like that, where there's like the guy in charge of the elves, the guy in charge of the Ents, the guy in charge of the giants, the, you know, this kind of thing. Just silence. You're just stunned.
I was just thinking, you know,
the thing I said was so incredible that you were just like, wow, my brain just shut off.
It's true. It collapsed at least part of the brain, but the other part of the brain that was still barely there, like, you know, like a flutter of electricity, was thinking about how entomology, you know, I bet the people that study Ents are quite upset that that doesn't mean their field of study.
It's true. Well, I think Ents are pretty understudied at the moment anyway.
Actually, that's probably not true. I bet there's like a giant chunk of Wikipedia dedicated to Ents. I think it's probably...
Yeah, no, yeah, I'm sorry. You're right.
More studied than the unhoused problem or something.
Literally true. Oh, my spouse sent me a news item that they're planning on bringing back dodos.
Oh, with cloning?
And I was like... Yeah, have you not seen Jurassic Park? Like, just like tell me that you haven't seen Jurassic Park without telling me you haven't seen Jurassic Park. They're like, let's bring back dodos. I'm like,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure that that's fine. You know, I don't think we're going to experience horrible results. You know, I don't think the dodos are going to come kill us. You know, it seemed like they were pretty peaceable creatures when we eradicated them the first time. But like, I don't know. Imagine
maybe
like
they were super
dodos
annoying.
Being a Yeah. Oh, I think they were goofy looking, at least. And I think cloned dodos, I mean, original dodos, or what if cloned dodos become like a reservoir for like a new, totally insane kind of like avian flu or something, you know? Like,
yeah.
What if that's the case? You know, it just seems sort of like, you know, I'm sure if you're putting this out there, science has progressed far enough that maybe this is 100% possible.
Yeah.
But... you should really just be like, listen, it's not worth it. You know, if you're going to bring something back, you could bring back something that recently, you know, like we've done such horrible work on this planet that we've made so much stuff extinct like this week. You know what I mean? Like this week, we made a bunch of stuff extinct. Why don't you bring back something that like literally just disappeared yesterday and like put it back where it's supposed to be? And then like, you know, like that way you'll be... aiding the continuity of that ecosystem as opposed to like a world that's been without dodos for what 200 years and you're just like, let's put them back in, folks, let's see if this is fun. You know, like if you have to clone extinct species, why not just pick one of the ones that we literally got rid of yesterday? Because, you know, we're doing it all the time. You know, put that rare wasp back in circulation or whatever, you know, like bring it back. Helpful pollinators, you know, bring them back. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I was wondering, my suspicion is that this Dodo project is funded by Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, or some fucking dumbass.
Yeah. James Cameron and Terry Gilliam collaborate on bringing back Dodo for, who knows what reason.
Did I tell you I saw James Cameron's submarine?
Oh, like when you were recycling? Like, wait, how'd that happen?
No, it was at the Museum of Natural History.
Oh, and they have it. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and for listeners who don't know, Jim Cameron became fascinated, I think, via making Titanic, right?
That's the narrative I have, yeah.
He became fascinated with the deep sea. And since, you know, every time he makes a movie, it's the highest grossing movie ever made. So because he has this special power to make literally, I think, the most money possible off of a movie every time he makes a movie. He had enough money to basically produce real fancy deep diving subs, and he got to go down to like the Marianas Trench as a guy and experience that. And I guess also do some real research or let you know, real scientists use his submarine as well. Just sort of appalling when you think of it, you know, like what, how much money exists on Earth, and then things that are like probably interesting and useful, we spend a fraction of that money on it. You know, like we sent the Mars, I know what the Mars rover budget was for the last one. It was $2 billion. And like Twitter was bought for $44 billion, right? Like Twitter's a website. It's like a fucking website. And the other one is driving a car on another planet.
Yeah.
You know, like consider how much more stuff we could, interesting, useful learning we could have done if those budgets were repurposed towards science or whatever, right? As opposed to, you know, a platform that sells you social outrage and harvests your information for advertising purposes. You know, it's like, it seems like that's like not as useful as driving a car and taking core samples of Mars, for example, or exploring the Marianas Trench or whatever. And it sucks that, like, you know, it's James Cameron and not, like, former talking show guest David Barkley or something like that, who goes down in the submarine to, like, examine the Marianas Trench in person or something like that. But what's amazing with the exhibit, first of all, like, the submarine is cool. It is genuinely pretty cool. And because it's now, like, an accessioned item in the museum's collection. Another funny part is it's like it's outside in like a tent, which normally wouldn't be that big a deal in Southern California, but because it's you know, it's a guarded tent, but because recently we've been experiencing so much like actual weather, there's all this great concern within the museum that the submarine not get wet, because it's a item in the collection, you know, and you can't get moisture into the collection.
You'd think that it could get wet.
Submarine was the last thing. Yeah, you'd think a submarine was literally like maybe the last thing on Earth.
Yeah,
that you would worry about it getting wet.
Yeah, probably.
Like literally everything else, you would be like, no, don't get that wet. And then they're like, the submarine, should we get it wet? You're like, you can probably get the submarine a little wet.
Yeah,
I bet the submarine that went to the bottom of the ocean in the Marianas Trench can 100% handle any amount of rain in Los Angeles.
I gotta say, you make a very good argument, Steve, but I'm on James Cameron's side with this one, because I feel like, you know, he's making these movies. It's really intense. I bet he has to be pretty hard on his crew, his infantry, and his placeholders.
His babies and placeholders.
Yeah, he has to be really hard on them. And I bet every once in a while, when he's trying to make, you know, break the record again, somebody comes up to him and says, sorry, Jim, I feel like I'm under a lot of pressure. And now he can say,
oh,
you've never been under real pressure. I've been under real pressure.
I have no doubt that he's actually said this to someone.
Yeah, you think this is pressure? You're at sea level, you little brat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was worth the cost. I think that's totally worth it to be able to fire off that zinger at your employees, whatever you want.
So, like, yeah, for the purpose of pun craft, you think this is worth it?
Yeah, exactly. Who cares about the housing crisis?
Yeah.
A pun goes a long way in human history.
Well, you might have you might have turned me to your side here, at least where James Cameron and the submarine is concerned. And you know what, I'm sure that my sort of gripes, like, you know, like sort of to steal from another blockbuster movie, you know, Indiana Jones saying, you know, like, this stuff shouldn't be the belong to weird rich people, this belongs in a museum, you know, like this research should be done by scientists and professionals, you know, oceanographers, not like a blockbuster movie directors. And I'm sure James Cameron said, you know, like, I have one way of doing things that I'm doing. That's the new way of doing things. It's faster and more efficient. And, you know, I've got this pile of money and I can just accomplish this right now, which with the traditional ways of doing this stuff, you know, requires going through various boards of certificate, you know, blah, 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 right? And has to go through the research dean of research at University X and combine the needs of University Y and yada, 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 yada. And so, I think these methodological conflicts are something that's like not exactly alien to our guest today on the talking show.
Not at all. All of you out there who thought, I mean, speaking of bizarre symbols and strange rituals, like naming large groups of aggressive men babies,
which you think would just turn them against you, first of all, too, right? If you were like you get the largest group of guys together and they're all mad and riled up and you've been training them so they're tough and strong. And then you say, all right, you babies. And they'd just be like, fuck you, man. There's one of you. There's thousands of us. You're dead. But anyway, sorry, I digress. Sorry,
it's true. Well, tonight we have the very elegant, the very debonair Andrew Barry on the show to help us understand the right and only way to make a ring.
Hi, I'm Andrew Barry, and welcome to At The Bench's YouTube channel. I had great fun making the last film about you have been taught the wrong way to make rings round. The link up above me by here if you haven't watched it already. And I am so glad I made that film. There was about 90 to 95% positive comments, both on Facebook and also here on YouTube as well, saying that is the way that we have been taught, or I wish I've been shown that way when I started making jewellery. We have been taught that D way of making rings, and I wish I'd seen your film at the very start. And then I've had a few other people saying, there is no right, there is no wrong way. I've had no problems with my joints cracking and so forth. And it's okay for you. You have all this machinery, blah, blah, and so forth. And whilst I appreciate all the comments that come in, I feel that I still put my hand on my heart and say the way that I showed you in the last film is the best way to make a ring round in this thickness metal. It is the thick, and I started off the film saying we're using very, very thick metal. Sure, if you want to use thin metal like we've got here and make it into this section, that's fine. It does make life a little bit harder for you. And I just loved all the comments and smiling to myself whenever I had a lovely positive comment. And anyway, okay, that's enough of that. So in this film, it's sort of a carrying on from the last film, although I'm not going to be playing around with these three rings that we made up. I'm just going to leave that. I'm going to let you suffer for another week or so whilst I show you something. Again, it's all about making these rings quicker and faster. I want to, again, prove other people wrong, not in a nasty way, but I like to help. I like to impart my knowledge. I'm not going to say the person's, the lady's name regarding these rings, saying that if it is a wrong way of doing things, well, then I suggest you go to the universities and colleges and tell them so. So if there's any universities and colleges out there who want me to come to you to perhaps teach a class to show you my way of making these rings, I am more than happy to. And that's the way it is. And I'm more than happy to go out there and to advise people and to show you my way. Admittedly, my way is not the only way, as you all know that. But I have been doing this for over 30 years. And over that period of time, I like to think I have perfected techniques because this is my profession. I do this for a living. And what I'm going to show you now, we're going to make up a silver ring. We are going to make it up the old-fashioned way, and we're going to make up a ring my way. I'm sort of going to time how long each of these are actually going to take from start to finish. And you will see that the way that I make the rings round and I will cut them is a lot quicker, a lot faster, and a lot more accurate than the old-fashioned way. And if I can make a ring using my technique that I'm going to show you now, in half the time it takes somebody to make a ring using the way they've been taught, cutting the ends, making it into this sort of odd D shape, if I can make it in half that time, it means that three things. It means that A, if I make it in half the time, I can charge half the amount. And everything that I do here in my shop is all about money and time. Time is money at the end of the day. So if you can make a ring in half the time, you can either A, charge half the amount, virtually half the amount. You can either B, make twice the amount of rings that the other person is actually making. And C, which is the bit that I quite like, is the fact that I can put my feet up for the other half of the time, read a paper, cup of coffee, knock off work a little bit earlier, knowing that I have made the same rings in the same style in half the time, and I can go and enjoy myself. And that's what life is all about. So, coming to what I'm going to be doing today. And again, this may be controversial to a lot of you, and please, I welcome all of your comments. Just pop them down in the box below. And I'll gladly read them, and I do appreciate it if you do that. And also, like this film, subscribe to my YouTube channel, also to atthebench.com, and also share this film as well, even if it's on YouTube or if you're watching this via Facebook. I'd love you to share this as well, because I think that the way I'm going to show you after this old-fashioned method is the best way, the quickest way, the more accurate way, and the cheapest way for you to make a ring. Okay, so I'll walk through this, and I'll talk as well going through this, and I'm going to start off making two rings, the old-fashioned way and my way. I've got in front of me here, as usual, a piece of silver. It's rectangular section, dimensions not important at the moment, but we're going to use our previous measurement of 65 millimeters, okay, for the length of the ring blank. And I'm going to do it in the old-fashioned way to start off with. So in the old-fashioned way, we would have a piece of metal that we would have perhaps from the bullion dealer, and perhaps the bullion dealer will cut it to 65 millimeters, because that's the length that you've asked for. But when they cut it, they use pliers. So what have you got to do? You've actually got to file the ends a little bit shorter, so they're completely flush, flat, 90 degrees to the edges and so forth. You have immediately lost a little bit of silver. That has gone in your tray. That's gone in your tray as lemel. Okay, not a problem though. But if you started off by 65 millimeters bit of metal from a bullion dealer, you filed it the ends flat, you have immediately made that piece of metal shorter. And if that piece of metal is shorter, the finger size is not going to be the right size that you originally want. Let me grab my table and I'll explain all that to you. Okay, I wasn't actually prepared for that. So the idea is you should know how long a piece of metal should be. You can work on the circumference of the ring, add the thickness of the metal and times it by pi, and that gives you the required length. Or you can make life a lot easier. You can get these ring blank sizing tables from At The Bench, atthebench.com. Join up as a Freeview member. Click above in the top nav bar, you've got resources. Download this for free. They're also available on the internet as well. We've measured the thickness of metal. It's 1 millimeter. And I said I was going to work on 65. I'm not going to. I'm going to work on 61, because 1 millimeter equates to 60.9 for a size Q. So that's what I'm going to do in this film. Not 65, but 60.9. So we're going to call that 61 millimeters. So 1 millimeter, size Q, 60.9. So you ring up the bullion dealer, hello, can I have piece of silver, blah, 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 61 millimeters, please. Certainly not a problem. Metal comes, you've got to file the ends. Your piece of metal is not 61 millimeters anymore. It's most probably going to be in the region of 60 millimeters. If that's the case, you've lost a millimeter. Your blank is going to be in the region of a size P now. So you've lost one size. So what have you got to do once you've made the ring? You have to make that ring bigger. Okay, so that's my argument to start off with. All right then, so we're going to make that 61. So that should be size Q. So even if you have your piece of metal from the bullion dealer, you still really can't measure on this outside edge because they've squashed it. 60.9, so we're going to call that 61, okay? So there we go. So that's 61 from there to there. Old-fashioned method. Right, let's cut that. And depending on how good your cutting is, we're going to cut. Okay, 61, there we go, there it is there. I like it. Oops, Daisy, there we go. So there's my bit of metal, 61. Oh, the ends aren't quite straight. Okay, so let's file them, shall we? Let's just file these ends nice and straight. Okay, immediately you start to file these. You may have cut on the waist side, well done. If you haven't and you've cut on the line, you've immediately filed, you've immediately made that metal that little bit shorter again. So, your bit of metal now is a fraction less than the right size than 61. Okay, so we got that. So let's just bend this round. It's thin enough, I can use a pair of half rounds for this. All right then, so I'm going to make this in the way that most, well, not most people, that a lot of people have been doing recently. We're going to make these ends, we're going to make it in this sort of shape, this D sort of shape. Make sure that the lines across here are flat. Make sure they come together. And you line these up and you go, oh, do you know what? They're not quite meeting because when you solder, the ends are going to come together completely parallel. So well, they're not quite, are they? Because well, let's bend that into parallel that way. And the ends aren't really touching. Okay, so we get a file and we file. Okay, and then we put this together. Not quite the other side needs a bit of filing. Okay, so this is what you are usually told to do. File the ends, okay? Let's try that. So I filed the ends again. Come along. Make sure they're all, it's all straight. Make sure it all comes together. Do you know what? Still not. So you'll carry on and you keep on filing and filing and filing. And a lot of people have problems filing completely straight. So they're going to perhaps rock the file back and forth accidentally. And they're going to have a hell of a time trying to keep these ends completely parallel. Because once you've sort of gone this way and you turn the ring around and you try and straighten it out that way, when you come to put the ends together, they're going to be like almost like touching in the middle like this. And you're never going to get it straight. So what a lot of people will say, that's no problem. Come along and pass a saw frame through the joints. That'll remove any of the high spots. Fantastic. Love it. That's a really good idea. And I'm not saying sarcastically because that is a really good idea. If you can't quite get the ends parallel, pass a saw frame through. Okay, so I'll pass a saw frame through. Brilliant. Okay, so do you know what? You've removed more metal from the ends of the metal. And you know what? They're not quite meeting on the inside either. So you're going to be doing this. You're going to be bending this back and forth, trying to get these ends together so they meet absolutely flush. Again, I've just made my metal shorter again by passing the blade through. So every time you touch these surfaces, you are making the metal shorter. And by making the metal shorter, you're making the finger size of this ring smaller every single time. All right, then. So, we've got that. All right, we've got that pretty much parallel and level. Great. Let's get a bit of emery paper. Again, I'm a stickler for cleanliness when it comes to soldering. Let's clean the insides and let's pop that up onto our soldering block. Okay. Doesn't matter what flux you use. I like using a bit of borax, always used it, always will. Absolutely brilliant. A little bit of solder on that. So you can see how long it's actually taken just to get to this stage to solder. Simple flame. And we'll go into solder our joint. Okay, make sure it's been come and pulled through to the inside. Okay, so we're gonna wait a few seconds just to bit that to become sort of like a black heat, so there's no color to that. Acid bath or safety pickle into the water, and there we go. And I'm not expecting this joint to crack, but you can see how the next step is going to be. Then we get our mandrel, put it up onto the mandrel, and now we've got to tap it. There we go. It's supposed to be a size Q. It's actually about a P and a half. So we got half a size difference. So we gotta tap it just to make it that little size bigger. All right, there we go. So that's the ring to a size Q. It's nice, nothing wrong with it. It's round, the joint is still okay, but that was the old fashioned method. So let me show you the way that I would make it, and I will show you how quick and far more accurate I can make that ring. So let's show you my way of cutting and making up this ring. Far quicker, far easier, far better. So we come to the end. We want to make this 61 millimeters. I still can't use the end, okay? That's being cut by a bullion dealer. You cannot use that. The end's been squashed. So we don't. We come in 2 or 3 millimeters in from the outside edge. We transfer that mark to the outside edge. We measure 61 millimeters. 61 comes to here. We transfer that mark to the outside edge. Next, we make the ring round. Again, it's thin enough, we can use our fingers for this and our half round pliers. Make the ring round. Now, a few people have asked me, well, what happens if you're doing this type of joint and the metal is very wide? There's no way you can really do the joint like that. Exactly. What we're going to do in this case is simply overlap the joints. So we're going to pass this section underneath the wire. Just like that, and bring that around. And the idea is where we've transferred our marks onto this outside edge, we get them to line up. Okay? Simple as that. And if you want to do it in one pass, you can do. If you want to do it in two passes, it's entirely up to you. So there's my mark on the inside, there's my mark on the outside. They both line up. All right, I haven't made one saw cut yet, whereas in the previous film, whereas in the previous ring, I've already cut it to length. So that's two cuts, I haven't even made one cut yet. Now I'm gonna pass my saw through where I've just marked, straight through the joint on the other side. In one cut, all the way through. nearly there. There. Okay, I've made one saw cut. If I sawed vertically, no problem. If I'd sawed at a funny angle this way, it's no problem, because now each face on that is parallel. Now I can simply move the one down into place. That joint is absolutely beautifully parallel with the other. All right, there we go. You can see how beautiful and parallel it is. I haven't filed it, haven't done anything, haven't passed a saw frame through it. That's just one cut. Let's come to solder that. Flux on the inside, flux on the outside. Little bit of solder. So far I'm about twice as fast as my last method. Here we go. Onto there, make fit to solder. Bam, turn it over. Make sure the solder comes through for the inside. Brilliant. Wait a few seconds, pop that into the acid, into the water. There we go. And now let's tap this round. Just dry it off a moment. And let's just tap this round. Okay, so there we go. No more hammering than what I did with the last one. Bring that into place. And as you can see, the camera wants to focus on this. Focus. There we go. That now is spot on PQ. I always go to the middle of the bands. Never go to a leading edge. Always go to the middle of the band, especially on a nice wide band like this. So that there, spot on, a size Q. Now you have to agree that that method was easier, was faster, and far more accurate than the old school way that I originally showed you. And if you're saying, well, it's okay, you cut through two pieces of metal with one saw cut. Yeah, I did that. But even if you just had to make two saw cuts and you couldn't quite get those pieces overlapped and aligned exactly, you could cut through one and then simply cut through the other one by moving the saw blade to one side, and you can easily cut the ends parallel. And if you keep that piece of metal on your peg and don't turn it over to cut the other end, even if you cut one end at a wonky angle this way and cut the other end at the same wonky angle that way, those ends will be parallel. So there's no need to file, there's no need to trim the ends. And this is what I get so frustrated about, is when people tell you to order the exact size metal, then file it. No, the metal's getting shorter. Cut the metal before you bend it round. File the ends. No, if you've cut it slightly too big and you turn the ring round and you try and file the ends nice and flat, that's better. But still, there are lots of people who cannot file perfectly straight, and they file one a little bit and they make it a little bit rocky and they make it this way. So when the ends come together, they still don't meet, and they have to pass a saw blade through. And all the time, the metal is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And the finger size then is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And this is the frustration that people get when making rings. They have been taught one method that then gets taught to another, that then gets taught to another person, without thinking, what am I doing? Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Is there a better way of doing this? So as you have just seen, I have made that ring in, I'd say I haven't even been timing this, so I'm sure you'll agree that that second method is quicker, faster, and easier than that first method. That's all I've got to say in this film. Please, comment on this. I'd love you to comment if you're watching this via Facebook. Please, I'd love you to comment. Let me know what you think about my way. Let me know what you think about the old-fashioned way. If it's right, if it's wrong, what are your experiences with this? Will my method make your life easier? Do you not care? That's fine. I don't mind at all. But I am showing you ways of making jewelry that aid you. You don't become frustrated. And I said to one of the Facebook friends, saying that I don't mind going out teaching these ways. If you don't like it, that's fine. If you don't want to do it this way, that's fine. Whatever method suits you is fine. But just have an open mind when it comes to accepting other people's methods. They may be completely wrong. They may be completely right. Just have an open mind. Think about it. Think about the ways that I have just made that ring. Think about the old-fashioned ways. And just see the reasons why I do make rings like that. Because for me, time is money. I have hardly wasted any silver. I have got that little bit of silver left over that I've got. I can use that. Even if I ordered a piece of metal that was about 2 or 3 millimeters longer than what I actually needed, that's fine. You're going to get some waste when it comes to metal, and the customer will pay for the whole length. What's 2 or 3 millimeters extra on a little piece of silver wire like that? 20 pence? Not even that, because what's that? That's less than half a gram. So you can afford to cut off those ends to make a proper joint. You don't need the machinery. You just need a mandrel, a ring stick, a rawhide mallet, and a pair of half round pliers. It's what every basic jewelry person's toolkit should have. Even if you've hardly got any money, those are the essentials that you're going to need. So there's no excuse. So share this film. I would love you to like it, comment on it. If you don't like it, give me a thumbs down. I really don't mind. If you like it and you agree with what I'm saying and you understand it, give me a thumbs up, leave me a comment down below if you're watching this on YouTube, and I would love to have a read. In the meantime, I am going to do a film using these three thick pieces of metal now. Look out for it in the next film. In the meantime, my name's Andrew Berry for At The Benches YouTube channel. See you on the next film. Bye-bye.
Wow. Excuse me. Wow. Goodness.
Whoa, you okay over there?
Yeah, I just choked on some little bit of myself.
Some wow.
Yeah. Wasn't cut out for the wow today, which is nothing that says nothing to do about Mr. Barry's performance. That was slick, I'd say.
I found it very stressful. I have to say that the sort of internecine conflicts and the sort of like, I dare you to thumbs down, you know, if you feel like you should thumb, you know, if you disagree, then that's fine. I'm fine with that. I felt like as a non-combatant, I have no stakes in how rings are made. So far as I understood it, rings were only made in a volcano in Mordor. Like, that's the only understanding of the factura of rings that I'm aware. I'm sure that's not how they're all made. I'm sure some of them are made at a factory in China or whatever. But, like, I have no clue how rings are made. So the only knowledge I have is, like, yeah, you know, like, we make one ring to bind them all, and you do it, you forge it, like a dwarf forges it in the mountain of Mordor or something, right? That's what happened?
Yeah. Well, I think maybe, I'm sorry, I should have said this in the preface. There was some misconception here. Of course, there was a good deal of drama surrounding what is the correct or incorrect way to make a ring. Andrew even offers to come to your university to teach you and your professors the right way to do jewelry making. But Andrew Berry is first and foremost a filmmaker.
Yes, right.
So the drama that came out, it's hard to tell with Andrew. He's such a good filmmaker, whether or not he actually believes in this way of this mode of making a ring, or if it was just part of the script, really.
Right, right. And I suppose also, you know, in terms of the sort of methodological conflict, he would have considered the way that, Sauron was bound by the ring, etc. Before, you know, when he's talking about the right way and the wrong way, he's like, look, there's just a faster way.
Yeah.
You can do it that way, but this is a more efficient, faster way of doing that, you know, which, you know, maybe you don't have to go all the way to Mordor to throw it back into the volcano, you know? Maybe that's not necessary. Maybe you can leave the Ents alone. And the Ents can just do their thing, and they don't have to come, you know, they don't have to be involved.
Why start a war? Basically, he could have saved all of Middle Earth with this.
Things would have been so chill.
Yeah. It could just, yeah, it just would have been called Earth. It would have been.
I would like the haters in the YouTube comments who are like, this is an incorrect way to produce rings, to just consider what the alternatives would have been.
Yeah.
You know? It's a counterfactual. We can't prove things. This is all history. It's all water under the bridge.
It is amazing to watch, you know, what I've come to understand as like classical British politeness engage with something like the YouTube commentary section, where, I mean, Andrew takes it real seriously, as if, you know, people didn't make mean comments for the sake of, you know, comment pour la comment.
I think that, to be fair, he's like defending sort of like a almost like a philosophy of practice, to sort of, is that Gramsci?
I'm not sure.
The philosophy of practice, like that was his sort of way of getting around the Italian prison censors, for writing, instead of, cause he couldn't say Marxism, right? Cause the fascists were like, you can't write that, buddy. No, you can't say that. And he was like, oh, the philosophy of praxis. I digress. You know, he's sort of like articulating sort of a modus vivendi, a philosophy of practice, you know, where it's how do you do this? You're like, you do this in a way that allows you to have more time on your hands. You do this in a way that lets you make two rings in the same amount of time as you make one, or lets you make the one ring you were going to make today and then go for a walk, as opposed to making the one ring all day or something.
Yeah, I like how the goal is more leisure, not more profit. That's nice.
Yeah, I mean, he claims that he also charges half as much, which would definitely be the opposite of how mechanization, since he's a small holder, one presumes, right? He's in business for himself. One presumes that, like, mechanization, if any new technique is new technology, so to speak, right? That he's not raising, keeping prices static, but reducing the amount of time to production, so therefore increasing his margin. Seems like he's interested in maintaining exactly the same margin, but just having more spare time.
True.
Which I think is, well, maybe we can assume, based on this, that he's a labor voter, at least, in the United Kingdom, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption.
Yeah, yeah. But you said I disagreed with you there. I was like, well, this guy seems like he is on a war path. He is this guy's got his critics in his sights, and he's like coming out shooting.
But he was also so polite about it in his own way. Like, imagine the American version of that video. Like, the guy would be buff and tattooed and screaming.
He'd be in his car.
Yeah. Exactly.
He'd be making rings somehow in the front seat of his like Escalade,
right?
And yelling into the camera.
I guess the popular representations of English polite society that make it over to our shores rarely show the Englishman as kind of razzled by somebody doing something wrong. It was delightful to me.
I think the reason why I was able to interpret this as hostility, which I think might be the correct interpretation, is I've recently been watching the British detective show Inspector Morse.
Okay.
Which is entirely set, you know, I'm out of episodes of Columbo at this point, right? I need to find sort of vaguely fish out of watery middle-aged police detective stories to watch. Or I'll die like a shark that stops moving. And but with the thing about Inspector Morse is it's entirely set in Oxford. And so like in Columbo, many of the villains are people who feel like they are superior to whoever they're talking to in the police, right? And in Columbo, it's because they're, you know, captains of industry or movie stars or something like that. And in the case of Inspector Morse, it's because they're, you know, the world's number one expert on Greek vases or something like that. They're connected to the university, and therefore, you know, there isn't a smarter person on earth than me, actually. I'm officially the world's smartest guy on topic X.
Right.
And so I cannot, you know, I can't be touched by the likes of you. And Morse himself is often like, no one No one ever hardly raises a voice, but he'll come in and interview someone, and he's known for being very brusque and rude, and you know, and to me, it's more polite. You know, certainly more pleases and thank yous and more or better manners than I think I have ever experienced consistently. You know, like to me. But meanwhile, the person he's interviewing will be like, "Are you always so churlish, Inspector Morse?" You know, like, and I was like, you know, and now that I've watched, you know, whatever, 10, 12 episodes, I'm sort of now swimming in that water. But initially, you know, you're sort of like, okay, that was, you know, like, so this is churlish. Okay. You know, this man's angry and he's leading a combative exchange with this person, despite the fact that it seems to me, like you said about this, our guest's performance today, that this is the picture of politeness.
Right. You know? This is politeness with a real bee in his bonnet.
And this is politeness within a very specific sort of English style of communicating, which is, in fact, like, I am out here screaming the names of my enemies in the streets, right, challenging them to duels, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, but no, I'm not, actually. You know, like, yeah. To us, we're like, wow. Okay, yeah, Mr. Polite Guy.
If you said that you knew a better way to make a ring 200 years ago, our towns would have started a little war.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. I would have gone and nailed my 95 theses about how to make rings to your church's door, and then about 80 years of genocide would ensue on both sides. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you have a flair for politeness or rude commentary, we highly encourage you to check out Andrew's YouTube channel and, you know, stash some praise or criticism in there, because clearly he'll get to it.
Yeah, you know, reading the comments, addressing his their concerns, etc., a powerful performance.
Yeah. Whereas if you choose to make commentary on our website, we're good. Good old fashioned Angelinos.
Address all mail to Solomon Bothwell.
Yeah.
Care of
send it to our general. We're just placeholders.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
We only work here.
I'm actually a baby.
You're Sergeant Baby.
Sergeant, it's me, Sergeant Baby. I'm baby.
Well,
yeah.
Good morning, Chinatown.
Good night. Yeah, it's amazing what happens when